Greetings. Thanksgiving greetings. Well, I am a year older than the last time we spoke.
Yes, happy birthday.
Thank you. So, in the remaining time that I have left on Earth, I will proceed with this message. We're in message number 64 in our series, The Rudiments Unto Perfection, the Whole Counsel of God. Tonight we're going to speak on the subject of planning and saving. Of planning and saving. We're talking about saving, we're obviously talking about money. And to put it real simple, to sketch what we'll be discussing in the next three or four studies, there's several things that people can do with money. One, you can earn money, as in make the money, not counterfeiting, but properly doing it correctly. That is, your fingers are given strength by God to make wealth. Okay, so that's either the acquiring or the earning or the laboring for money. That's one area. So you can get money. You can spend money. All right, where you buy something with your money. So there's the idea of purchasing, normal commerce, trafficking in merchandise, things like that, buying and selling. Well understood idea. In that case, when you're buying something, you're getting something in return for your money. You give with the intent of getting something back. I'm giving you $20, I'd like that CD back. You spend your money and you walk into a theater and enjoy a show. Spend your money and you have a new coat that fits you, the old one's worn out, simple things like that. Then there's giving money with no intent of return, which is charitable giving, alms giving, aiding the poor, the downtrodden, the fatherless, the widow. That's another area. Here again, money is leaving your hand, but it is not with the intent of getting something back, it is being divided, a portion being given to those in need. And then in between the two poles of bringing money in and moving money out of your grasp, out of your reach, out of your dominion and your control, is saving money. That's where we are accumulating wealth, riches. We can call this several things. You can call this laying up treasure for oneself, or laying up something, an inheritance for your children. In either case, we are depositing wealth and storing it. Now, the notion of storing wealth is not unknown. The Bible talks about, in fact, storehouses for silver and gold for God. And in fact, it's the point of Malachi. You know, God is robbed when we fail to bring money, our tithe, into God's storehouse, where God saves, wants that money to be saved, but not saved for its own sake, saved to be used. Okay, and that's one of the big issues about saving something. When the Bible talks about the notion of laying something up, it is always for use, not for saving for its own sake. Okay, that's something we're going to have to learn real quick here. And there's a whole squadron of scriptures that are real clear about what is legitimate saving and what is not going to be honored by God. We must recall the main point of last week's lesson, which was a planning and frustration, that one thing we know, when we make a plan and it doesn't conform with God's will, then that plan will be confounded and frustrated and overturned, right? And the solution, we said, was if we want to avoid that scenario, the best odds were to make our plan God's plan, for us to shift our point of view so that we're thinking God's thoughts after Him. And that's the whole point of the Christian walk. The more mature someone becomes in their Christian walk, the more they are thinking God's thoughts after Him, one, and two, the more cognizant and acutely aware they are of how far off they are from that standard. Because as they get closer and closer to the standard of God, it widens out and brightens into a brighter and brighter light like the sun, and they realize how far short they fall, such that many of the greatest saints of God become more acutely aware of their personal sin, even though they were esteemed upright men by their colleagues of inestimable holiness and piety. And they, much to our surprise, regard themselves as the more sinful. Perhaps it's not unusual for Paul to regard himself as the chief of sinners in that connection. Okay. But it's important to see that one of the things we want to do is to think God's thoughts after Him, which is to say, to see things God's way, to measure and evaluate and understand things as God sees them. And that is the mark of the mature Christian. The immature Christian sees things his way and not God's way. And that gap is what causes most of the grief. And that's the area of growth for that Christian. And that growth for that individual, male or female, may be painless or painful. But growth it'll have to be, because the Christian walk is growth. If you're not moving forward in Christ, you're definitely going to be falling back, because there's no standing still. because that's not growth anyway. The world will pass you by. You're falling behind. It always chagrins people when I point out the book of Hebrews expects pretty well 3.5 years or so, 3 to 3.5 years, full stature in Christ, understanding the rudiments of God. So in that connection, we want to set the main point that when we're talking about the subject of savings, we will be well advised to make our point of view the point of view of God. In that case, we will not be saving in vain for openers, because we can prove pretty conclusively from the scriptures we'll be looking at tonight that if you're laying something up and it's not according to the will of God, you're not laying it up for who you think you are, be that yourself or somebody else. It is not being laid up for who you think you are. All wealth is being laid up for who God wants it to go to. Period. Okay. Maybe not. You might not see it this generation, but it will not be who you think it's going to. For openers, it can't be for yourself, because one day we will all die. And we came into the world naked, and we're going to leave the world naked with nothing except spiritual treasure. Everything laid up on earth, where moth and rust destroy, will gain us little to nothing. So it'll be left behind for someone else, period. Okay. Now, keeping that mindset in view, we can see where God is going to go with this kind of stuff. Now, I did say that our best odds, not that a roll of the dice has anything to do with it, because God is providentially ordering everything, but I said our best odds are to have God's plan being our plan. But I want you to know that even that is not necessarily a guarantee in this life. And I can think of no better example than Job to prove that. That here's a man whose plan was God's plan, whose thinking was God's thinking, who went beyond any known man. The man that God could point to of all the people in the entire world as an example of Satan, of someone who's not under the dominion of sin, but in everything he did tried to please God with absolute integrity and sincerity. The most righteous man on earth, who did everything as God, such that God was pleased to honor him and say, "Have you considered my servant Job? How he's upright in everything he does." Here's a man who was rich. Let's turn to the book of Job and get a feel for the picture here so that you'd have a real good background and not labor under any misunderstandings. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil, avoided evil, turned his back from it. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. So he obviously had an inheritance in children as well. We know from Psalm 127 that children are the heritage or the inheritance of the Lord too, as much if not more valuable to him than property are his children, showing the blessedness of God. 7 sons, 3 daughters. His substance, and that's the word that is used throughout the book of Job and several other passages to show his possessions, what he has saved up, what is under his hand and under his control. His substance was also 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. So we're talking about a man who knew about savings. What's interesting, by the way, is the nature of the things. Remember I said earlier that God intends wealth for use. This man, Job, had lots of gold and silver too. You can prove that from Job 42, where the restoration was twice what he had before, and he had a bunch of gold and silver in 42. So we have to assume he had half that much gold and silver in Job chapter 1 prior to the trial. Why is it not mentioned? Because gold and silver is not intrinsically useful for anything. You can't eat gold or silver. They can only be used to transact for something else. But these things are useful. Sheep are useful for clothing, for drinking. The milk that the Bible talks about is not cow's milk, of course, it's goat's milk. So this is wealth in the true sense of the word. The sheep mentioned first. By the way, of these sheep, guess where he got what he needed for sacrificing to God continually? This herd of sheep he used to honor God by sacrificing to God with those sheep. So this was, I want to really point this out and expand on this, that we see that this just was any old flock of sheep. This was a flock of sheep that Job used for religious use as well. He used this flock of sheep to honor God. It was not like the camels or anything else. He would pull the best of the unblemished sheep, and he would set them aside and sacrifice them and burn them to God. Remember, after his sons had feasted, said perchance they might have sinned in their heart and blasphemed God because they are wealthy in their own right, because they can feast each other and invite the sisters and everything. I mean, that's pretty wealthy. And so he would offer a sacrifice and burn these sheep and honor God thereby. So here we know that not only does he own these sheep, but he uses the sheep to honor God. The purpose for which the sheep are there is to enjoy them for what they provide, but also he honors God with the sheep through his continual sacrificing. And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of the feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. So he had a continual supply of sheep to sacrifice to God, and God received this gladly. According to the number of his sons, he atoned for their sins using this flock of sheep. Now there was a day, and the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, doth Job fear God for naught? By the way, you notice that Satan always asks, speaks in questions. He doesn't assert because he can't say he's insincere. He simply raises the question about Job's sincerity, doesn't he? Just like, hath God said, you know, you will die if you eat this? You know, it's a very deceptive fellow, this Satan guy. Hast not thou made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? You know something? Who would notice that there was a hedge? There was no physical hedge. Why would Satan notice a hedge? There is no physical hedge, right? We all agree that human eye can't see any hedge around the house, around Job's person. So who saw the hedge? And who's bothered by this hedge? Who? Yeah, who ran into the hedge? Ah, see? The hedge is not significant to the angels, who wouldn't bother, but someone who attempts to want to drag Job down and attack Job and ruin him runs into what? A hedge. That's pretty significant, isn't it? The source of this hedge was obviously God, but God hedged Job about, and his property, and what he had saved up, his substance, not only his household, but he himself and his sons and his substance, all had a hedge about them. Now think about that. Wouldn't you like, everyone talks about, I'd like to have a hedge against inflation, I have a little gold stuffed aside. That gold isn't going to do a doggone thing for you at all. You need to have this hedge, the hedge that Job had, to be a protection against anything. See? It's the kind of hedge that Satan can't get around, that Satan would love to dig through and can't. See? That's the hedge. So we always pass by this passage and think about it, you know, some barrier or something, but that God can offer that barrier to anyone who pleases God. And that's the secret to not having, because it's obvious that Satan's been going to and fro the earth wanting to dig past, but can't penetrate into Job's territory, Job's domain. Job is upright. And consequently, because he does everything the law of God requires and honors God with his substance is protected. Okay? That's better than FDIC insurance for your bank account, which, by the way, is catastrophic for both America, which, you know, funds the stuff, and for people who trust in it, who find that, you know, banks can fail and not protect those deposits. This is the hedge we need. Okay. But it's interesting to know that it's Satan who notices the hedge. God didn't bring it up. Satan says, because you're hedging him about, it's no wonder that he honors you, because self-interest is motivating Job. Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. Oh, now, who has blessed his hands, work of his hands, his labor? God. But why not? Satan's complaining about this, isn't he? But why would God bless the work of a wicked person? That makes no sense. God, being true to himself, blesses the work of the hands of the righteous and the upright. And his substance is increased because he is upright. So not only does he have, but he increases the amount that he has. So his savings, what he has laid up, is laid up in greater number all the time. It's an increasing treasure that Job has. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. In other words, take it all away. Remove the hedge. And of course, Satan's telling God to do it. God turns it around and says, no, you do it. Because if I do it, you'll say, I held back. I'll let you do your worst. Okay. So God allows Satan permission. Just don't touch his body. Right? So the hedge is going to be pulled down as a test of Job's sincerity and integrity. Now, we never know whether we're going to be in this boat, do we? Job is a righteous man, and here he's going to suffer. So we can never say that the Bible doesn't speak about the suffering of the righteous. There's a whole book about it in Job. We're going to pull out a separate lesson from it, though, then that topic. Important thing is to see what happens to him and why in his response. And then the focus that Job has that we have to share to get the picture right. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. And there was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. So now they're in the oldest son's house, which he having the double portion would be the richest of the sons too. So it would probably be the biggest of the feasts of all time, bigger than his other brothers would have. And there came a messenger unto Job, and said, the oxen were plowing, and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them, and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. So he's lost all his oxen and all the asses by the Sabaeans. And see what Satan has done? He provoked the Sabaeans to sin by an unprovoked attack on Job. It's quite an achievement to get a whole nation to come up against Job, who was the richest man in Arabia. Wham! So there's two sins here involved, isn't there? Satan's, of course, and what he's doing, but the Sabaean sin too. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the fire of God is fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped to tell thee. So before Job has a chance to respond, the next bit of news, 3,000 sheep, which he had honored God through sacrificing, are gone. And of course, the servant, innocently enough, declares it to be the fire of God because lightning fell. Of course, it wasn't God's fire. It was satanically articulated. But Satan wanted to make it look like it was God's displeasure raining down upon Job, which it was not. The source of the lightning was not displeasure. But it's significant that it was the sheep that he used for sacrifice. And the implication would be not only when the servant says the fire of God came down, but my sacrifices may not have been pleasing to God if he was willing to destroy all 3,000 sheep, which I was using to offer back up to God. See? So you can see the religious implication in Job's mind. What would we think if we had laid up some special wealth just for God, for serving God, and bam, it was blown away? What would we conclude? God frowned upon it. But that interpretation would be the interpretation of Job's so-called friends, wouldn't it? And it wasn't the case, was it? So long as he was truly upright, which he was. But you can see how Satan has orchestrated this to be the most astonishing attack on what Job has laid up in his substance. And now, the coup d'etat for Satan. When he was yet speaking, there came also another, and said, the Chaldeans made out three bands, and fell upon the camels, and have carried them away, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I am alone to tell thee. So the thousands of camels are gone. And then, while he was yet speaking, there came also another, and said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from this wilderness, and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young man, and they are dead, and I alone am escaped to tell thee. So he lost even his most fundamental inheritance, his children, all gone, all the camels, all the sheep, all the oxen, all the servants. And they were out working. It wasn't as if they weren't paying attention, the servants. They were out in the field watching the flocks when the Sabaeans came. They were watching the sheep. when the lightning came down. Only one servant escaped from each of the incidents for the intent to tell Job. And Satan made sure they were all told Job, so that Job had no chance to even catch his breath. So this was an accumulated effect, so that Job would instantly, out of the top of his head, curse God. Well planned from Satan's point of view. It looked like God was really upset with Job. And that was part of the deception of Satan. Then Job arose and rent his mantle, showing his remorse and grief for what had happened, and shaved his head, and fell down upon the ground and worshipped, and said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And all this Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. His perspective is, this is the way I started out. I came from the dust, and now I'm no better off or no worse off than I was when I was born. He suffered that loss, that diminution of his substance back to where he was. No children, no substance, nothing. He's totally demoted. To what? To where he was in the first place. So he sees no fundamental loss, though he grieves for the loss of his children. He's unhappy about the loss, I'm sure, but he gives full credit to God. So he had a lot. Now he's lost it all. As we know, the story progresses and he loses even his health at that point. But it's important to see his perspective on what he had. So very few of us are going to be put in this extreme position of Job, of losing everything up to having nothing. And even if it should happen, what's the right approach? That's the way I started life. And that's the way I'm going to exit life. So the fact that I've been reduced back down here again is not truly relevant, because God gave me fingers, strengthened my fingers to make wealth, and I can start again. That's the appropriate approach, isn't it? Matter of fact, it's exactly what happens when he is vindicated. Let's turn all the way back to Job 42 and see the vindication sequence. Verse 7 of chapter 42. "And it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, My wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. Therefore take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go up to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for him will I accept. Lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job." So he instructs his friends, who gave bad theological advice and maligned Job in the process because of their faulty view of providence, to offer up sacrifices, and then Job would pray for them. Verse 9. "So Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did according to as the Lord commanded them. The Lord also accepted Job." And verse 10, notice, "And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends." Okay. The confession of sin was one thing. Of course, he had every reason to be upset with his friends, because God surely was upset with his friends. But he received his friends when they brought the sacrifices to Job, who functioned as a priest in this period of time. And he prayed for his friends. And it was at the point that he prayed for his friends that restoration comes upon Job. Now keep in mind that for almost the entire book of Job, from chapter 3 on to the point when Elihu comes on the scene, which is around 37, 36 or 37, for all those chapters, Job is not praying for his friends, nor are they sacrificing because of their sin. They are fighting and disputing amongst each other. God has not given any restoration or peace or reconciliation while they're disputing. But when Job prays for his friends, then the restoration, the returning of the captivity, starts to occur. That's when God's grace breaks loose. Matthew Henry observes that God's going to not be blessing us with our fights amongst ourselves on theological matters, which this was a theological argument, a long one, but when we pray for one another, different. That's when God's grace is released, not with good arguments, but with profoundly sincere prayers for those with which we differ, like he with his three friends. That's the point when the restoration occurs for Job. "Also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters, And all they that had been of his acquaintance before, and did eat bread with him in his house, and they bemoaned him, and comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Every man also gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. The earring was a conventional kind of ornament, and being an ornament, it was a luxury, and so they were well, it was not any skin off their nose to offer the earrings to Job, because he was in necessity. But they had this in abundance, the earring, so they gladly took the earrings off and gave them to Job. Job puts it to his account in Job, I believe it's the 6th chapter, that he did not ask for anything, though he was in need. He said, I didn't ask you to give you of my substance, of your substance to me. He'd rather suffer quietly than to beg to have stuff from them. By the way, that was Paul's attitude too. He said, I have not asked for anything. I worked with my own hands making tents rather than have reproach come on the church of God that I ask for sustenance from you, even though I have a right to it. Job had a right to help from his friends, his acquaintances, since he had served them so well, but he didn't ask for it. And they didn't offer it, though they should have. Now they do offer it. But does he turn it down? I think most people would not want to be built back up again by charitable contributions. Pride and arrogance forbid it. And he accepted them pulling the earrings off and giving them to him. Most people say, no thanks, it's okay, I'll get by on my own steam, thanks. He was not beneath accepting the contributions and the offerings to him. Think about that. He was a man who was the richest person in the known world. Perhaps, period. In the then known world, inhabited world. And he was willing to take charitable contributions. But he never asked for a single thing. He never put it on anyone's conscience when he could have used it. Right? Boy, what a it's usually the other way around. We'll get snotty and ask, why don't you help me? You see I'm in trouble. And put up and demand collections and arrange for money to come our way. Or then we get snooty and say, keep the money, I don't need your money. Arrogance and wanting to put other people out when we could do something else for ourselves. So he got a bunch of money and gold. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than the beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camel, 1,000 yoke of ox, and 1,000 yoke she-asses. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Now notice that all the amounts of the oxen, camel, sheep are all doubled from what they were before. But he still has, what, 7 sons and 7 daughters. How is that inheritance doubled? Exactly. He has a host in heaven and a host on earth. Because they're not gone. They're just gone to be with the Lord, and he will join them. And he will have twice as many when he goes to heaven himself, which is at the last verse. He is gathered to his fathers at that point in time. And, of course, he names them and shows how he even gives them an inheritance among their children. And he lived and died, etc., etc. And the story ends very, very nicely. But it's important to see that everything that he had laid up for everything he did was returned to him. But boy, through what kind of trial did he finally get it all back? But he did get it all back. And what was the basis on which he got it back? He was upright. And God put the hedge back after the test was met. But we never know if our faith is really going to be put to a test of sincerity like his was, a fiery trial, to check and to see how we relate to what we've laid up. First step was the substance. Second step was his health. We concentrate on the first element. We've skipped the second. So, keeping in mind that we do come into the world naked. Excuse me. Just pinned your meters there. We can see that we should own possess things as not possessing them. And the purpose for saving things or laying them up must be that for a purpose that God has authorized. Okay. Because material is given to us for use. Matter of fact, Matthew Henry says, money is like steer manure. It's only good if you spread it around. Okay. Not to be kept. What good is storing a bunch of steer manure going to do anybody, right? But in the spreading around of the money, something good comes of it. And therefore good things are to come from the money. One of the foremost elements that we should discuss, apart from which we wouldn't be able to understand this, is some of the discussion that Job has about the subject of money. And this is reflected also in Ecclesiastes. We'll start with Ecclesiastes because that's got the better overview. Turn to Ecclesiastes 5. Starting with verse 9. Ecclesiastes 5:9 reads, "Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes?" I won't go into the next verse about the fact that you lose sleep if you lay up money for yourself. But we'll concentrate on this thing. One, the wealth of the earth, the profit of it, the fruit of it, is for everybody. Even the king relies on what comes out of the ground, because he can't eat silver and gold, as we pointed out. He has to eat what comes out of the ground, or what feeds on the ground, like animals, cows, beef and chicken and poultry and things like that, eggs. All really comes out of the earth. It's for everybody. But this attitude toward the money should not be that one of covetousness. The whole subject really boils down to covetousness being one of the most horrendous sins. One of the main problems with this sin is that it's self-perpetuating. It grows on itself. It's like an itch that when you scratch it, itches more, and you scratch it more, and eventually you tear your skin open, and the lesion grows with leaps and bounds to the point when it's fatal. That's what love of money is in verse 10. But verse 11 puts a little different picture on it. Notice, as we increase the amount of our substance, as we increase the amount of treasure that we lay up, and our income increases, the amount of mouths that are there to feed increase. If I have a small 10-man business, as a case in point, I probably will not produce as much as a business which has 100 people or 1,000. But if I grow the business and increase it to a 1,000-man business, oh yes, it is bringing in maybe $1 million a month instead of 100,000 a month. But I also have 1,000 people to pay, and bigger tax brackets, and other concerns. As a family grows, it too can be in this position. So you see that God kind of puts a limit on some savings, doesn't he? If you were to increase the amount that you're making, but all your outgo remained constant, and then you could say, I've got more substance sitting there. But Ecclesiastes says that's not normally the rule. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? All you can do is watch as it's consumed. Now that's not a bad thing if you're the right frame of mind. If you believe better to give than to receive, and you're a merciful, compassionate individual, then this would bring joy to your heart. But if you're not, this would be vexatious and a vanity to you. Right? The more you make, the more goes out, and you virtually are running where you were. You're not getting ahead because the number that's consuming it is increasing it. I know my own family went from 2 to 6 in a relatively reasonable time frame. And now that they're in Christian school, I make a lot more than I did just 10 years ago. But verse 11 says, and I can confirm it, it's all, I'll just watch it all be consumed away. All for a good cause, near as I can gather. In God's providence, it's all properly being used. But it's all being used. And so savings is not, do we not come easily by it. There is no additional excess, despite the increased capacity for earning that I have. I can personally testify to the veracity of the scripture. In fact, God will see to it that all scripture are borne out to be true and reflect the true state of affairs. So, yeah, we can just watch and see. Which means that if we have the right time frame of mind, it won't be vexatious. It'll be a bit of a blessing to us to take notice of this fact. And be the frame of mind that we're pleased to see that the substance that we have is being put to good use. A, in our own family, our own affairs, our own business, and beyond. Stretching out our hand to the poor, for example. And in connection with that, let's turn back to, say, Ecclesiastes 2. For God giveth to, verse 26. For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he giveth travail, to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Notice here that the things that God gives. In fact, if we back up a couple of verses. Verse 24, there is nothing better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten thereunto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. Let me actually read that in Leupold's translation, which is actually a little bit better, in fact, a lot better based on the original Hebrew. You have to pay attention since you don't have this in front of you. So be careful. You'll see it's remarkably different in the first two verses, but it is correct Hebraically. The King James has got a bad translation. It is not a good thing inherent in man that he is able to eat and drink and get satisfaction in his toil. This too have I seen, that such a thing is entirely from the hand of God. That's a very different 24th verse. Even the ability to enjoy the things that we have comes from God. Without him, there would be no enjoyment. So what enjoyment we do have comes totally from God's hand. Verse 25, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment apart from him? Okay. Very different reading of the verse. 26 is a little bit more what we're used to. For to the man who is good in his sight, he gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he gives the vexation of gathering and heaping up in order to give to the man that is good in God's sight. This to his vanity and striving for wind. See the difference here? The vexation given to the sinner is that he, being unrighteous, is not going to be given the joy of the things that he has. His joy is an empty, vain joy, futile. There is no enjoyment in anything except that God gives it. All other is striving for wind. Okay. It's a very different text. That stands in the original Hebrew of Ecclesiastes 2. And consequently, what we learn from that is we don't want to be in the shoes of the man who's heaping up money for someone else. Right? We should be striving after the kingdom of God, that it's all put to God's use, and primarily for our children and our children's children. Okay. In this connection, we can see that it's one of God's, he seems to love doing this, having unrighteous people work, he doesn't give them any joy in it, and then they're vexed when they see that the money that they thought was going for what they had planned is diverted by God's providence into the pockets of who? The upright, the righteous, the Christians, God's covenant people, receive the fruit that was worked for by these people, who by dint of their sin are not allowed to enjoy it. It's given for the joy, the joyful use, more accurately, of God's covenant people. This is hammered home by Job himself. Turn with me to Job 27. And he was in a good position to know, so we would take anything Job had to say about it pretty seriously. We can start with verse 13 for context. 27:13. This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors, which they shall receive of the Almighty. If his children be multiplied, it is for the sword, and if his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those that remain of him shall be buried in death, and his widows shall not weep. And pay attention to the next two verses. Though he heap up silver as the dust, and prepare raiment as the clay, he may prepare it, but the just shall put it on, and the innocent shall divide the silver. You have clothing so much so that it's like clay, as numerous as clay in your household. And heaping up silver like the dust, so as much silver in your room as dust could hold. You get the idea, a ton of it. You may prepare it, but the just shall put on the clothes. And you might heap up the silver, but the innocent shall divide it. Now, here's the picture. Watch actually how I gesture. He is heaping up a big stack of silver. He's putting it all together in one place. That's what the wicked man is doing, unrighteously with the money. What do the innocent do? They divide it, halves, quarters, into little bit pieces, and it's used, it's put into circulation and subdivided down. He heaps up into one concentrated lump the silver as dust, but the innocent subdivided into smaller pieces and put it into distribution. Matter of fact, one of the things is to divide a portion with the poor. This is actual biblical lingo, if you will, terminology from the Torah, to divide a portion with the poor, the spoils, as it were. Those that went into battle versus those who stayed behind and did home support on the behind the lines, as you were. All this is battle language, too. So they divide the silver that was accumulated. And here we can see that the whole purpose of this unrighteous man accumulating and saving the silver is put asunder, because not only is it not saved for the purpose that he intended it, which was to give it to his children, doubtless, but rather the innocent take possession of it, and rather than keeping it all together, it's subdivided into smaller and smaller pieces, and it goes where it's needed. See? Talk about planning and frustration like we talked about last week, or last session. Here's a pretty obvious case, where the plans of the wicked for the money are totally overturned and confounded by God, who turns it over to the innocent. Just like Ecclesiastes 2:26 said, it's a fixation for them that they work and accumulate it, and God simply turns it over to the just to use. And that ostensibly is us. In one form or the other, we may not know the form it takes. But sure enough, if he's accumulating and putting together the mound, God's not going to allow that mound to stand. He's going to chop it and divide it into pieces and let the innocent divide it further. Because it's in the nature of the unrighteous man to build up the single mound of money. It's in the nature of the righteous people to divide it to the people who need it and to put it into use. Because they know, hey, I came in naked to the world, I'm going to go out naked. So apart from certain basic provisions which God does make for inheritance and wise use, the rest needs to be put into use, into circulation. And laying up treasures for ourselves is not a good thing, as a rule of thumb. Job was one of the few who could do it, and it would be great if we could do like Job did. But the reason that he was able to do it is that God put the hedge around him. And so he didn't accumulate the gold and the silver and the huge flocks because he wanted them specifically, but because he wanted to please God in everything he did. Everything, the work of his hands was prospered, and he ended up with that stuff anyway. And then he ended up with twice as much stuff, and the latter end of Job was greater than the first by dint of the hedge that protected everything he did. He was able to start from nothing again and do better than he did before. He's a pretty old man at this point, I'd imagine. You know, imagine at the start of his travail, being that people like Elihu, who was a pretty wise fellow, regarded these men as elderly and had hoary heads. For Job to build back double the amount of wealth in his old age is pretty astonishing. Shows the power of the hedge. And we can have access to that power, but not on our own terms. It's not going to happen that way. On God's terms, we can put ourselves under God's hedge. It's there for us to tuck ourselves under. But it's not there to call it our way. We need to move under the hedge, which is to say we need to change our plans to work with God's plans. Then saving makes sense in that context. At this point, let's look at 2 Corinthians 12:14. This is one of the texts where we have warrant for laying something up. Interestingly enough, I'm going to tell you that the text does not go far enough. Not often that we criticize Paul, but I have a biblical reason for making a very minor criticism. He has his reason for saying it, phrasing it the way he does, but he doesn't go as far as the Old Testament text does. 2 Corinthians 12:14. Behold, the third time I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours, but you. That is, I don't seek your substance, that which belongs to you, your possessions. I seek you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. Okay. So he's making a biblical theological point here and making this contrast. The parents ought to lay up for the children, not the children for the parents. Okay. He sees himself as their parent in the faith, so he's going to lay up for them, not them for him, as it were. But the doctrine that he's quoting from is an important one. The parents are to lay up, that is, to save things for their children, to prepare the inheritance that's going to be propagated in time forward to our children. The laws for that propagation, that continuity into the future, because what we're talking about is succession from you to your children and beyond. This is the area where savings is most significant and valid in the biblical point of view, is the capitalizing, if you will, or the underwriting or the support, financial support, of the godly seed. See? The general rule is sons first, and the oldest son, double portion, because he also has double responsibility. When your parents are old, he's supposed to take care of them, not the younger sons, but the oldest. And then the daughters, and then sisters and brothers, if you don't have sons or daughters to give to that are righteous. You're to cut off unrighteous children. In some cases, you can even overturn the rule of the firstborn. Reuben, firstborn Jacob, didn't get the double portion, didn't deserve it. Joseph received it. God overruled it. And then we even saw the famous example of the blessings that Jacob gave to Ephraim, Manasseh, I believe. And he crossed his hands, displeased Joseph immensely, but God saw it that way. That was the way the blessing was to distribute, God's way. So there's a way that those blessings are distributed, but we see here that we are called upon, and Paul says we must, it is our job, our duty, to lay up for our children. You've all seen the bumper sticker saying, you know, we're spending our children's inheritance. Criminal, sinful in the extreme to be doing that when you should be laying up for your children and you're squandering it instead. If anything is an overt attack on the family and its future, that is it, to fail to lay up for your children. Matter of fact, it's the rapture doctrine is intended to derail a lot of Christians on this. They were so certain that they were going to hightail it out of here on the cosmic elevator that they failed in this signal duty, which was not, by the way, just an Old Testament text. It came out of Paul in 2 Corinthians, which was well after their written well after the rapture verses that everyone was talking about. So obviously Paul saw that as a very important duty. Even if the doctrine were correct, they would have fallen short of what Paul demanded. And it's even worse if their doctrine is erroneous, which it probably is. See, the parents are to lay up for the children. Just any children, the righteous seed. All the more reason to do everything you can to train up your children in righteousness, that they would therefore have a claim on that inheritance which belongs rightfully to them. But remember I said that Paul does not go far enough in this text? The text is a halfway text, because all he wants to pull out of it is a comparison between Old Testament practice and his attitude toward the Corinthians. The subtext on which this is founded is a much better text. It's from Proverbs, 13th chapter. Proverbs 13:22. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. Now that's a different story, isn't it? The good man leaves an inheritance not for his children, for his children's children. Now that's a tough one to do. How are you going to guarantee that your grandchildren have an inheritance from you? Remember I said that Paul didn't go all the way? You can see what I'm saying. It's one thing to lay up for your children, where you probably have a right and some stretch of hand to see to it. It's something altogether more difficult, particularly in the course of time, to distribute your inheritance to your grandchildren. It can be done. But there's another constraint on it. It must be distributed to the godly seed. And that may be something that happens after you are no longer here. So how do you see to the distribution of your inheritance to your grandchildren if you're no longer here?
That's tough.
It's tough, and there's only one way to do it, is to train your children to observe the same rule so that they're preparing to, A, that they're raising righteous seed and that they're being cognizant of their duty with respect to the inheritance to their children, your grandchildren, and that they likewise are preparing an inheritance for your great-grandchildren, which is their grandchildren. You see that God stretches his hand and expects us to see 3+ generations into the future and to prepare for it. It's the verse like this that Paul inspired that elder candidate that Reshtuni spoke of, the one who refused, even though he was a righteous man, had a righteous family, to accept the post of elder because he said, I'll wait until my grandchildren are raised. The proof will be there. See? Where did that doctrine come from? Was it just a bunch of spiritual fluff? Uh-uh. You can see the position of Proverbs 13:22 would support such a point of view like that. And when he was certain that his inheritance was properly directed into the second generation after him, then he could have confidence that he had fulfilled all righteousness with respect to his duties, right? And then, and only then, was he willing to become an elder in the full sense of the word, having discharged this duty to his grandchildren. Now that's a hard... But you notice, this is the purpose of saving, isn't it? The good man will lay up an inheritance for his children's children. Two generations you have to think about. I have to worry about Charity's children and my son's children. And my eye has to be on them though they not be born, though they still be in their loins. That's the focal point for my saving, for my laying up treasure. And if it's, and there's several ways that that's done. There is literal saving of silver, gold, dollars. But there's also the fact that they being the inheritance of the Lord, I have a responsibility also to train them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So their Christian education comes into bear. Raising them up according to the nurture and admonition of the Lord is part and parcel of that. Failing to do that, all the saving of the money in the world is not going to do any good, because it would be sinful to give them the money if they're not righteous, if they're wicked, if they should be apostate and fall from the faith to which they were born and baptized. Once being made citizens of the household of faith, they would be like dogs returning to the vomit if they turn aside. So I have a very important duty with respect to my children, if I'm ever to see righteous grandchildren, or if I should die before they are born, to go to the Lord knowing that the molds are all cast in the right shape, to see to it that I could have that confidence that my inheritance is laid up for my children's children, and they will receive it because they will have earned the right to receive it and to move it forward in time. God believes in the succession of the generations. What a nasty thing this idea of the me generation is, when in fact we should be worried about the generation 2 points ahead of us and planning for that. The me generation sucks all interest and all focus into itself, just looks inward on itself and worries about itself. And as a consequence, it rejects and it turns its back on and it cuts loose the future. The future is undercut and ruined because of their attitude. If we're thinking grandchildren in terms of our purpose, in terms of planning with the money that we have, we're in a different boat. And that's how the kingdom of God is going to be prospered, from people who are taking this perspective. That'll do it. Do it on two counts. One, we're doing what the good man does, but what's the second part of the verse? And the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. Now, I think I'm going to think the two things do go in hand, because as we know, what? We're able to plan in God's providence, putting ourselves under his law and seeking his face and his will, two generations forward. Let the wicked try to pull that stunt of directing his inheritance two generations into the future. Not going to happen, because his inheritance is laid up for the just. The just lay up their inheritance for their grandchildren, and the wicked lay it up for the just. They can't get it into their grandchildren. Their seed is dispossessed. They suffer from disinheritance. God disinherits the wicked and supports the inheritance and the heirship of the godly seed. Not the ungodly, but the godly seed. That's where we stand here.
This verse has a post-millennial flair to
it. It could be understood that way with justice. What it's seeing is that, in fact, that in the same sense that the meek shall inherit the earth has a post-millennial flair to it. If God is taking money away from the wicked because it's one of his pleases him to vex them with this terrible rerouting. You talk about wealth redistribution, right? Socialism has its own idea. We take the wealth and money from you and give to them. God does it in spades, and there's not anyone who can stop him from redistributing the wealth. Because A, God works on the long time scale. He lives in eternity, inhabits eternity. So he can move something here in 1993 and distribute it the year 2112 as he sees fit. And he will direct the course of those dollars or that wealth for centuries in advance, where it's going to go. There was wealth laid up in Egypt for centuries prior to it being what? Taken off by the Israelites as they crossed through the Red Sea. They took all the jewelry and all the gold and all the silver of Egypt. All laid up for the righteous. All gone. All that vexatious work that went into the manufacturing of all that wealth of Egypt. Gone. All the wealth of Canaan committed to God. We weren't supposed to take what didn't belong to us. That's what Achan's sin was. And hiding it in a little ditch, a little hole in his tent, and bringing grief upon Israel. So we see here what the pattern's going to be, right? We are called to save, but not for ourselves. And not just for our children, but for our children's children. That means that the children listening tonight, anyone listening to this tape who's young, you may be planning for wealth that's going to be around in your grandchildren's lives, functioning a century from now. And there's two kinds of treasures. There's treasures in heaven, and there's treasures on earth. One is certainly more important than the other. They both have their part to play. However, all the treasure on earth will do you nothing if you don't have treasure in heaven. You must definitely make the sacrifice for the pearl of great price, the kingdom of God. Everything else comes into play thereafter. But short of that, we're in bad shape. Turn with me to Proverbs 28, 8. He that by usury and unjust gain increaseth his substance, he shall gather it for him that will pity the poor. Remember, I was talking a little bit late earlier about the use of something being put. Here's the case of somebody increasing substance, which means that he's saving up and increasing his heap of silver. But where does it actually go? Before, we talked about it more simply, that the wealth of the wicked is laid up for the just, something we've heard 1,000 times, doubtless, in our Christian walk. Here's a little different twist on it. The one who gains and increases his substance unrighteously, it is given to who? To him who will pity the poor. The person who hoards his money and it acquires it wrongly and holds onto it wrongly by hoarding it. Remember that I talked about that big collected pile of silver? I said it's going to be divided by the innocent. So too, the increased substance, which is all in one place, is going to be what? Going to be given to people who pity the poor. And I don't mean they did this, oh, what a pity. Not that kind of pity. I mean people who put their pity for the poor into charitable action. People who will disperse freely and divide the portion to the poor to help them. Right? So, if you're holding on to money, and it's just increase of substance for its own sake, guess what? It's going to be taken away from you, and it's going to be given to somebody who will give it to the poor, who will be generous and not stingy with it, who will not fail to do his duty to the poor. Matter of fact, Job goes to the point of actually demanding that God have his right shoulder drop off of his body if I failed to help the fatherless or the widow or the poor when I saw that they needed help and I didn't help them. Or I looked the other way or did anything other than actually pull out my purse and give them what they needed. So if I did that once, may my right shoulder fall off. My whole arm gone. Of course, it didn't happen. Why? Because every single instance that Job had, every opportunity he had to help the poor, was he generous? He was the most righteous man on earth, wasn't he? Every chance he did, he had an open purse policy of helping them or giving them a camel or a sheep, whatever would get them up and off and going. Jesus did almost the same thing. One thing you lack, right? Sell everything you have, give it to the temple, give it to the priest, give it to me, give to the poor, right? And you shall have treasure in heaven. This is what Job gained all the time with his use of his money, as he continued to use it to get additional treasure in heaven. Because he had additional treasure in heaven, he got more money. The more he tried to give it away, the more he kept getting back. Why? Because God takes the money from the people who just want to accumulate it and save it up and gives it to people who pity the poor, who will be generous to those who are struck down in poverty. It's no wonder that God has so many different provisions in the law for the poor. Laws about gleaning and a whole category of scriptures, not grinding the face of the poor, things like this. And he expects our attitude to those who have little to nothing to reflect his compassion and mercy. It's one of the things that reflects a divine attribute in us. But we have reflected a satanic attribute if we cling to the money rather than be generous. One of the things that commends the perfect wife in Proverbs 31 is she stretches forth her hands to the poor. That is, she's giving them what they need to get by. She doesn't forget them. Doesn't turn her back on them. Now, ironically, the poor are some of the some of the worst offenders. There's a proverb. I won't quote it tonight, but I did come across it in my studies. It says it's particularly bad if a poor person should elevate to power and they really become oppressive of other poor people. And they should be the most merciful, having risen from the poor, become some of the worst oppressors. The best way to avoid that is to be prosperous. And God does want people to be prosperous, that we may always have the poor with us. And why they're always there? To put us to the test. To see whether we're saving up for ourselves or whether we're being generous to the poor. And it's always in proportion as you have. God doesn't expect us to give what we don't have. But he sure drew a lot of attention to the widow's mite being tossed in to the treasury, right? If that's all you have and you put it in, it counts big time in God's eyes. Because even what, at least what little you had, you were willing to share. In this case, to give to God, but in other instances, to give to the poor. Ecclesiastes and Proverbs both tell us that you could, if I was in the context of one of these passages, I believe it's 28, let me just verify that. Oh, by the way, verse 3 of 28:3 is the text about the poor man. A poor man that oppresseth the poor is like a sweeping rain which leaveth no food. That's where it points out that the poor, when they oppress the other poor people, are in bad shape. Well, I don't want to drag us along if I don't happen to have the address of that scripture, but it was in the context. Here it is. It's in chapter 13, Proverbs 13:23. Much food is in the tillage of the poor. What does that mean? We're talking about the poor, the poverty stricken again, right? Much food is in the tillage of the poor, which is to say that even if you're poor, if you work, if you labor, if you till what little you can get, or you glean the fields, there's food to be had. You will not starve. God makes it pretty clear that the poor will not starve, that they, through their hard work, will get by. But what's interesting is the very next clause. But there is, that is destroyed for want of judgment. That is, there is another example, or another person, who is not poor. There are people who are well off, who are destroyed for want of judgment. And that's ironic. That's one of the big ironies. Of course, all these proverbs are righteous like this, but the wicked like this. Here it is. The poor find that by working, by tilling the ground, they get a lot of food out. There's the other example of a person who, by all rights, should be rich, because they have a big income, but by want of judgment, that is, lack of judgment, are destroyed. They're sitting there penniless. I happen to know a case personally where that's almost certainly the case, where a $100,000 plus salary is gone, and they're living on close to the poverty level with a salary like that. Why? Want of judgment. And yet a poor person making a sixth or a seventh of that amount of money would be well fed. But they, with $100,000 plus cooking in to their, that's what the checks say on them, are sitting there and hurting financially. Which will raise issues that we'll talk about next week, apart from just saving the money, but the wise use of it, improper judgment with respect to money. I pointed out two things with respect to savings that we don't want to lose in our perspective. One, it must be saved for our children, as 2 Corinthians 12:14 says, which parents are to lay up for the children. And one step further, Proverbs 13:22 is to be inheritance for our children's children. Right? And then secondly, what is saved up is also laid up for the poor, that is subdivided to them. Of course, we see to our own house first, lest we be but less than infidels. He who doesn't take care of his own house first is in trouble. But the surplus food, the abundance of things that God adds beyond that, not for us to keep necessarily. It's for us to be generous with. And what does God do when we're generous to the poor? How many of us have put this to the test to see? You know, I always hear about pastors who's on radio say, put God to the test, send that tithe in, and you'll see that God bless you. But and usually send it in to them, the underlying message. But here, how many people are told, give to the poor and see what happens? I don't hear that counsel as often as send the tithe into this ministry and put God to the test. I do believe it tests God when you send money to some of these ministries. It really tests God's patience that we use the money that poorly and send to these people on the radio and TV. It tests God that He's continues to give us money to use so poorly. But what if we would give to the poor? Because we know that God will redirect money from people who hoard it and save it improperly to those who save with the intent to lay up for the poor and have pity on the poor. You know something what it means to have pity on the poor? It's not just emotional. Remember we talk about love as an action, it's an action verb, it's not just a feeling, it's an action, it's doing something. Pity is the same thing. You misunderstand pity if you think, oh, isn't that sad, a poor person on the corner, doesn't have any place to... That's not pity. You might think it's to pity them, it's not. It's pity when you do something about it. God doesn't ask us just to get emotional and to have pity on the poor, does He? It's just not supposed to be a warm feeling of remorse and sorrow on their behalf or sympathetic empathy. It's to do something. I mean, it should be the first, but that should energize to action. To pity the poor is to help the poor. And that's when savings can come in handy. Because if you're not saving money, you won't have anything to give to the poor, right? If you, as we learned from Ecclesiastes 5:11, excuse my throat, as we increase the income, out of mouths increase for it. So what abundance is there is to be directed toward saving up the inheritance for the children and, of course, for the poor. And then guess what? We'll leave this earth naked with nothing, and as it should be, because we'll be clothed with white linen and stand before God and sing hymns into eternity and be told, well done, good and faithful servant. Every dime was well spent. Even entertainment money can be well spent, too. Don't say that those things are frivolous and therefore not to be used. But it all finds its balance, doesn't it? We can do that. We can enjoy all the things that Job enjoyed. Matter of fact, he did not, notice, he did not participate in the feasts of his children. He stayed in his own house. Though doubtless he probably would have been the very first one that would have been invited by all his sons. Come on over, Dad. He would not. He would maintain his station at his home and then rise up early the next morning after the feast, call his sons and sanctify them and burn the sheep. But he did not instruct them to stop the riotous, I don't think it was riotous, I think they were honest sons, but he worried about it, that they may blaspheme God, they may drink a bit too much. The big sin that Deuteronomy talks about is, be careful, lest after you getting all of this wealth, you say, I got this by my own power, and you forget God who gave you the power to get wealthy. And he feared this in his sons, but they were feasting around the clock all the time. They were so well off. But he didn't stop them. He let them have their enjoyment of the feast. That was recreation and joy for them, but God gave it. God regulated it. Job worried about it, but he let his sons do it. And he took his own steps. He sacrificed the sheep. Lost a lot of sheep that way because of his sons feasting, just on the possibility that something wrong may happen. But that was his attitude. He was an older man, but he did not begrudge his sons' celebrations with their sisters and their fellow brethren, right? There was nothing wrong with it. We shouldn't take any of this false spiritualism into play here, as if that was some lower level of Christian walk being evidenced by Job's sons. Nonsense. But we know this. Job probably taught his sons, both his first set and his next seven, to be generous to the poor and to lay up for their children's children. And it all fell together. And it's no wonder he was the greatest, richest man with the most dominion in the entire region. That's how we should save up. Use Job as our example. We hopefully won't fall into the same test that Job fell under, but if we have the same attitude as Job, we'll come through any minor test of our sincerity rather well, and we'll stand as approved servants at the end of time when we won't have any savings to show. There'll be no bank account in heaven where you can show, hey, I got 11,000 laid aside, or I got equity over here and real estate over there. No, you don't. That's God's real estate in the first place, isn't it? And the silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord. So it's all stewardship. Therefore, God expects us to follow his rules. So to avoid frustration, let's not be the kind of people that God does wealth redistribution on. Let's be the recipients of God's wealth redistribution. And how? By putting ourselves under his hedge. And it's that simple. We'll continue on subjects of earning money and spending money in the next couple of weeks, and planning for that, how to plan it properly.